This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S.-Israel genocidal war against Gaza continues for over 4 months, with the death toll approaching 27,600, mostly women and children. Hamas says any ceasefire deal on Gaza should include ending the war, withdrawing all Israeli troops, and removing the blockade. And Yemen's army announces that it has targeted two ships belonging to the U.S. and the U.K. in the Red Sea. It's good to have you with us. We start this bulletin with the latest news from Gaza, where the relentless Israeli bombings and shelling further proves the regime's intent to keep committing genocide. The city of Khan Yunis has witnessed a fresh attack near a medical facility. The regime targeted the vicinity of Nasser Hospital. Six people were also killed in an Israeli strike on a residential building in Khan Yunis. The city has been the focal point of Israeli strikes in recent weeks. Medical facilities there have been affected as well, as they were under Israeli siege. Israel's genocidal war on Gaza is now in its fifth month. Around 27,600 people have been killed in the Palestinian territory since October the 7th. Palestinians have been enduring a catalog of miseries, including the lack of basic needs and displacement. Residents of the city of Rafah talk about their dire situation.
No place is safe, no place at all. Where shall we go? What shall we do? Shall we die? If we're meant to live, where shall we go?
Rafah is a densely crowded city bordering Egypt and occupied Palestinian territories. Israeli troops are pressed further south toward Rafah, as the regime had announced plans to expand its ground assault on the city. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is heading to Egypt in an effort to push for a new truce in the Gaza Strip. The top U.S. diplomat is scheduled to meet with Egyptian presidents on the second leg of his fifth trip to the region since October 7. This comes one day after he held talks with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Riyadh. Blinken is later expected to visit Israel and Qatar. His efforts to secure a new ceasefire come as the U.S. is facing growing criticism over its support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. Since the beginning of the war, Washington has provided Israel with weapons and backed its war crimes at the UN. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel is obstructing a ceasefire agreement in Gaza. Senior Hamas official Osama Hamdan said that Israel wants to continue its onslaught on Gaza and to keep the territory under siege. He reiterated the movement's demands for a ceasefire. Hamdan said it should be comprehensive and involve the full withdrawal of Israeli troops from the Strip, as well as the removal of the blockade on it. Hamas is currently reviewing a framework of a ceasefire deal that was offered to it after talks in Paris involving Israeli, American, Egyptian, and Qatari representatives. Israel is under pressure from the international community and even its own Western allies to stop the military offensive on Gaza, which has resulted in a large-scale death and destruction. In the Explainer program, Mahdi Abbasian elaborated on the truce deal proposed to Palestinian fighters and provides details as to how it could work to stop the onslaught in the Gaza Strip.
Okay, it seems like there is another plan on the table of Hamas and Israel to look at the ways to stop the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. This comes after preliminary discussions between Israel, the U.S., Egypt, Qatar. Hamas has confirmed receiving the proposal. So what exactly does this plan entail? Now, it is noteworthy to point out that this plan was first hashed out by the intelligence chiefs from Israel, the US, and Egypt, as well as the Prime Minister of Qatar, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman bin Jassim Al Thani, in Paris. They called it the three-stage truce plan. So, what are the three phases that were hashed out that is supposed to lead to an end of this aggression that would satisfy the demands of both Hamas resistance group and the Israeli regime and its extreme cabinet? The first phase would consist of a pause in fighting and the release of elderly, civilian, and women and children captives. Major deliveries of food and medicine to Gaza would resume. The second phase would see the release of female Israeli regime forces and male recruit regime forces, another increase in aid deliveries, and the restoration of utility services to Gaza. Finally, the third phase would see the release of bodies of deceased Israeli regime forces in exchange for Palestinian prisoners freed. There are preconditions that need to be abided by during each of the phases. Military operations from both sides would have to stop during each phase. A complete stop, something unthinkable at this juncture in time. Another precondition depends on the negotiations when it comes to captive and prisoner releases. The specific number of Palestinian prisoners to be released at each stage will be determined with a focus on those who face long prison sentences. If all goes according to the plan, then the war will end and Hamas will ultimately release male Israeli soldiers in exchange for Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails. Hamas demands for a ceasefire approval don't quite add up to the reported three-stage truce plan. Hamas has previously demanded a permanent ceasefire as a precondition to enter negotiations. It wants guarantees and a plan for rebuilding the enclave. The withdrawal of Israeli regime forces from Gaza is also a demand, with ending the blockade the final demand. But other key resistance officials have also some key demands that doesn't appear the Israeli regime can meet. This is what Ziad al-Nakhale, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, has said. A clear political solution that ensures the rights of Palestinians. Or how about Osama Hamdan, senior Hamas representative in Lebanon? He has said, in addition to the Hamas demands, that there needs to be an international recognition of Palestinians' right to self-determination, adding that there needs to be an establishment of an independent Palestinian state with Al-Quds as its capital. Something the Israeli PM and his cabinet have outright rejected. The far-right Israeli minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, appeared to suggest that a deal with Hamas would trigger a cabinet collapse and an end to this unity cabinet. In this post on X, he said that a reckless deal would equal a cabinet split. This would mean the end of a unity cabinet. Meanwhile, the tally keeps increasing. Over 27,000 Palestinians murdered and over around 224 Israeli regime forces taken out, although this figure is grossly underreported by the regime. So, as with all truce agreements, this is no exception. It will be a difficult one to achieve, especially given that some of the demands from either side are enough to prevent a truce from happening.
Israeli forces have carried out a raid on an area near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Several houses were stormed in the town of Al-Yamun. The regime's troops also clashed with Palestinians during the raid. The Israeli military has intensified its raids across the West Bank since October the 7th. The incursions are part of a larger campaign to crack down on Palestinians in the occupied territories amid the regime's onslaught on Gaza. Hundreds of Palestinians have been killed or abducted in the West Bank over the past 4 months. Well, tensions keep flaring up along Lebanon's southern border as the Hezbollah resistance movement and the Israeli regime continue exchanging fire. Hezbollah said in a statement that its forces have targeted Israel's Ramim barracks with two rockets, causing damage to the military facility. The Israeli military also launched attacks on several areas in southern Lebanon. There are still no reports of possible damage or casualties. Hezbollah has been exchanging fire with Israel since the beginning of the regime's onslaught on the Gaza Strip. The resistance movement says the attacks are in retaliation for the U.S.-Israeli genocide in the Palestinian territory. The Yemeni army says it has conducted two operations against American and British vessels in the Red Sea.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces, with the help of God, have carried out two military operations in the Red Sea. The first targeted the American ship Star Nasia, while the other one targeted the British ship Morning Tide, with suitable naval missiles and strikes were direct and accurate.
Sari described the operations as a response to the ongoing Israeli onslaught on Palestinians, as well as the U.S.-UK aggression against Yemen. He said that Sana'a reserves the right to self-defense and will continue to carry out more military operations against all hostile American and British targets in the Arab and Red Seas. He also stressed that the Yemeni armed forces will continue to attack Israeli-owned or Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea until the end of the siege of the Gaza Strip, as well as the deadly aggression there. We've spoken to Christopher Halali, researcher and political analyst in the U.S. He has said that Washington and its allies are trying to maintain their hegemony in the region by attacking resistance groups.
Both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are the parties of war. They're the parties of the military-industrial complex. They're beholden to their shareholders who want to see more war and bloodshed abroad. And the U.S. taxpayers are funding that. And so, of course, to go to your question about Yemen, the Yemeni people have been under U.S.-supported genocidal war now for 9+ years. And, of course, that was led by the Saudis and the Emiratis, this coalition against the Yemeni resistance. Now, of course, Yemen has taken the profound and heroic step to stand on the side of justice, to stand on the side of dignity, and to stand for the Palestinian people in their time. In the face of this genocide by the Zionist regime. The United States, of course, and its allies cannot tolerate this. They cannot tolerate anyone going against their power in the region. And of course, they recognize that the Houthis, that the Yemeni resistance are very powerful. They have, you know, Ansar Allah has a tremendous capability, and so they feel threatened by them. They feel threatened by their, taking over of ships, by their cutting off in the Bab al-Mandab Straits. They are very concerned about the power projection that the Yemeni resistance had, because it has affected the global economy.
The Islamic resistance in Iraq says it has carried out fresh attacks against Israeli positions in response to the regime's genocide in Gaza. The resistance group said it had carried out a drone attack against a target in the city of Umm al-Rashrash, also known as Eilat, in southern occupied Palestine. This is not the first time that Iraq-based resistance groups have hit Eilat after Israel started its onslaught on Gaza on October 7th. They've also carried out a number of attacks against U.S. bases in the region. They say that Washington is behind the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza and is to blame for more than 100,000 civilian casualties so far. Iran's ambassador to the U.N. has strongly condemned U.S. strikes on Iraq and on Syria, as well as its attacks on Yemen.
Iran strongly condemns the U.S. military attacks on Syria and Iraq territory. The U.S. military action is illegal and unjustified and blatantly violates the basic norms and principles of international law and the United Nations Charter, particularly paragraph 4 of Article 2 of the Charter. It is also a flagrant breach of Iraq and Syria territorial integrity, sovereignty, and political independence. Iran also strongly condemns the joint military action of the United States and the United Kingdom against Yemen, which constitute an obvious violation of the United Nations charters and international law.
Amir Saeed Irani made the comment while addressing a UN Security Council meeting on threats to international peace and security. He said that such illegal measures target civilians and vital infrastructure and pose a great threat to peace and security of the region. He also rejected U.S. claims that resistance forces in the region act on behalf of Iran.
All of the resistance groups in the region are independent, and their decisions and actions are motivated by their legitimate rights under international law that are ending the illegal presence of U.S. in their territories, stopping the genocide in Gaza, and ending the occupation of Palestinian territories. Therefore, any attempt to attribute these actions to Iran or its armed forces is misleading, baseless, and unacceptable.
Iran's ambassador asserted that Iran has never sought to escalate tensions in the region and it has no military bases in Iraq. The envoy noted that Iran's military advisors are present in Syria on the official request of the country's government. Irvani added that the only way to stop conflicts in the region is to abide by international law. He said this means forcing Israel to end its genocide in Gaza and the occupation of Palestinian territories, as well as terminating the U.S. military presence in Iraq and Syria. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says elites in the Muslim world have a duty to push their governments to sever ties with Israel. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says that enemies are trying to prevent the elite from assuming their growing role in the society in this regard. The leader added the negligence of the elite would result in heavy blows to the nation. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks while meeting with Air Defense Force commanders. The meeting came ahead of the anniversary of a key event before the fruition of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. On February 8, 1979, and 3 days before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's Air Force personnel met with the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, in Tehran. The manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Feroz Al-Najim, stresses the importance of Muslim people in West Asia, pressuring their governments to cut ties with Israel.
With this battle against the evil, cruel Zionist regime and all the crimes that they're committing inside Palestine, especially in Gaza, and most of the world is witnessing this with social media these days. I think he's very, very precise, and he's hitting the right areas, and he wants maximum pressure against the Zionist regime. And the thing is, the Axis of Resistance is doing their part in militarily getting involved and hitting the Zionist regime from different areas, from Lebanon, from Yemen, from Iraq, and so on. And it's very important for the Muslims and the free people that live in the region, especially, that they put pressure on their governments and their regimes to somehow be at support with the Palestinians, because unfortunately, a lot of these regimes are still doing trade with the Zionist entity, and that they're still somehow being lenient with the Zionist entity with all the crimes that they're committing against the Palestinians. So it's very important for the society itself to start to push and make some pressure and somehow kind of corner these regimes and give them an ultimatum that they have to listen to the people, because if they don't listen to the people, there's going to be instability.
A new UK court ruling has revealed that Israel and its Western backers have been suppressing conversations on the true nature of the Israeli regime. In a landmark event, the British Employment Tribunal has issued a verdict that proves workplace discrimination over anti-Zionist beliefs. The case was brought forward against Bristol University by David Miller, an academic, sociologist, and public relations expert. Miller has experienced discrimination for his philosophical beliefs about the inherently racist, imperialist, and colonial nature of Zionism. The tribunal substantiated Miller's claim, revealing that he was unjustly and wrongly dismissed. This judgment also establishes for the first time ever that anti-Zionist beliefs are protected in the workplace. Miller was fired in 2021 for speaking out against Israeli crimes against Palestinians. Earlier, we were joined by David Miller himself, who shared his views about the court ruling.
I didn't want to believe it could be possible, but I'm not surprised. The evidence given in court by the university's own witnesses made it perfectly plain that the reason that they had dismissed me was not because I had upset Zionist students who said that they had been made to feel unsafe, but rather that the views that I expressed, the anti-Zionist views I expressed, were the key thing which tipped over their decision into firing me on the spot. So it was perfectly plain from their evidence that was the case, and I'm very pleased that the judge and the two panelists who worked with the judge have treated this fairly and professionally and have come up with a judgment which can't really be questioned at all, it seems to me. So there was a real sense there that the evidence in court was exactly what led to the judgment which has been released in court today.
Thanks for tuning in. It's bye-bye for now.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bafizi, 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 Ey shahidon rahe khuda, Ey karde, bahre ehyay haq jan fada, Kas patre, patre ye khun paak shoma, Mi
Islamic Revolution and Eradication of Deprivation. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Although Iranian people from all strata participated in the struggles leading to the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the deprived and poor stratum played the main role in materialization of this victory. They were strongly opposed to the policies of the regime and the spread of the decadent Western culture, which was in pursuit of uprooting of religion and prevalence of promiscuity. The poor were also the most discriminated and oppressed parts of society. Therefore, among the main goals of the Islamic Revolution was to eradicate deprivation and injustice. In view of this, immediately after the glorious triumph of the revolution, development of deprived regions, especially villages, was out in the agenda. In the sixth episode of the special series on the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we will very briefly dwell upon some of the indexes of progress in the field of eradication of poverty and deprivation in the country. Stay tuned, please. The father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said, "I don't think there is a worship superior to servicing the deprived." In fact, Imam Khomeini's guidelines and emphasis urge people, particularly the youth, to rush to the help of poor regions. Thus, a special organization was formed in the first month of the revolution called Construction Jihad. This popular body, which can be followed and copied as the best model of an NGO, was shaped up of young volunteers of mainly noted universities who were worried about the welfare of their fellow countrymen in their regions. Thus, they rushed to villages and outskirts of big cities to provide them water, power, road, hygiene, and other vital necessities. Many of these volunteers helped rural areas in harvesting their crops. During the regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, nearly 75% of citizens and some 12% of rural regions enjoyed potable water. But now, the whole population in cities and more than 90% of villages have access to healthy and hygienic water. This has taken place so rapidly that, according to the recent report of the World Bank, the Islamic Republic ranks first in the region in the field of access to potable water in cities and villages. This while Iran is located in one of the driest regions in the world. Electricity is one of the main factors of welfare and development in any country. However, during the Shah's regime, despite his ample claims on the progress of Iran, the country, there were less than 3,000 power subscriptions, while the figure has increased 12 times after the Islamic Revolution. The production of power has also had a similar upsurge. Today, all houses in cities and villages enjoy electricity, and this has put Iran above the average global rank. Another gargantuan achievement of the Islamic Revolution is the spread of gas grid to almost entire country. As Iran is the second rich country in terms of oil and gas reserves in the world, in the waning years of the despotic regime of Mohammad Reza, the oil exports were 6 million barrels per day, whereas people were suffering from fuel scarcity. Thus, nearly half of the villages would heat their homes with wood. But now, gas lines have reached the remotest areas in the country so that 98% of inhabitants of cities and 83% of villagers enjoy natural gas. As for health and hygiene, rural regions and remote places lived in pitiable and very poor conditions during the Shah's regime. The Shah had done almost nothing in villages, and only 37% of cities enjoyed hospitals. The Islamic Revolution, however, totally changed the situation so that today, nearly 95% of cities have hospitals. There are approximately 1,000 active hospitals and 150,000 beds in hospitals in the country. These hospitals are equipped with advanced devices and apparatuses, most of which are made inside the country. Moreover, there are 18,000 health centers in rural districts, while this figure was only 134 before the revolution. In addition to health and treatment progresses, the healthcare insurance has had a dramatic increase, covering 95% of the population. While in the Shah's regime, very few enjoyed healthcare insurance and services, today, 45 million Iranians, about 60% of the population, have been insured. Interestingly, 60% of this number lives in villages. According to the new health insurance, they do not pay for treatments. Furthermore, the life expectancy has increased from 53 to 80 among women, from 55 to 76 among men. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, "The Islamic Republic is among the most successful ruling systems in the world in terms of replacement of service and wealth from the center, capital, to the whole country, and from the rich districts of cities to the lower parts."
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Oh, as the fatalities of Palestinians now are over 27,000 in the continuous Israeli genocide on Gaza, the United States Congress is set to vote to increase Washington's support for the regime. Next week, the House of Representatives will vote on advancing more than $14 billion more dollars in military aid to the Zionist regime. So is it that Washington's answer to the Zionist genocide is to up the ante and give the regime more weapons and support in order to kill more Palestinians? Well, we will look at this and other questions on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guest to the program. Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria out of Manchester. And Charlotte Cates, international coordinator of Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, I'd like to start off with Charlotte. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, Charlotte, nearly 27,500 Palestinians have been murdered since October, with many instances of massacres, torture, and crimes against humanity. It's so mind-boggling that this genocide is continuing. Your thoughts on why the world has failed to stop this genocide?
One of the things that's been very clear since October 7th and beyond is that the imperialist powers like the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Canada are lined up arm in arm to prevent the Palestinian people and their resistance and the resistance forces in the region from realizing their goals of the liberation of Palestine and the liberation of the region from U.S. imperialism. And that they see in the growing strength of the resistance forces an existential threat to this regime of plunder, domination, and subjugation, which they've imposed upon the entire region for decades and indeed centuries. And so when we talk, when we are saying this, we're not just seeing like a failure on the part of world agencies. We're seeing a very explicit and deliberate genocide being carried out by the Zionist regime in league with these states, with these countries that are fully complicit in this ongoing genocide and are doing everything possible to make it last longer and be worse for the Palestinian people. I mean, this is why we're seeing the United States and its allies bombing Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. This is why we're seeing the United States talking about shipping $14 billion of new weapons to the so-called Israeli regime on top of the $4 billion that they already send on an annual basis. Now, on the other hand, what we're seeing is an unprecedented level of resistance involvement from forces in the region, and we're also seeing an unprecedented level of popular support for the Palestinian people and absolute abhorrence of this genocide being conducted by the Zionist regime. I think more people than ever around the world recognize today that Zionism is racism and are willing to go out in the streets, are willing to take risks, to get arrested, to protest, to organize, to face down Zionist intimidation and smear campaigns, because people cannot sit by and allow a genocide to take place, especially in their name and with their tax dollars.
Yes, indeed. And you talked about with the United States and giving more weapons. Would you say in reality that it's the United States which is actually at war with the Palestinians?
Well, you know, yes, the United States is at war with the Palestinian people, and it has been. I mean, for over 75 years, the U.S. has always backed and supported the Zionist colonization of Palestine. It took over as the primary sponsor of the Zionist colonial project in the region, and it has armed and funded it since that time. I mean, U.S. officials have, you know, routinely referred to the Zionist regime as essentially an aircraft carrier for the United States in the region, said if there isn't an Israel, we'd have to create it. And why would you have to create it? In order to serve the interests of the United States, to divide the Arab people from one another, to divide the peoples and nations of the region from one another, and to impose this essentially this military garrison in occupied Palestine in the heart of the region. And so this has always been a U.S. war on the Palestinian people. This has always been an imperialist war on the Palestinian people. And that's why it's the U.S.'s weapons that are causing the destruction and devastation that we see today. And it's also the U.S.'s weapons that are being destroyed by the Palestinian resistance.
Now, hopefully our other guest, Peter, will be able to join us. So far, we don't have him. But I'm going to stay with you, Charlotte. You talked about, on the one hand, Peter will join us in a minute. He's just coming in, and hopefully everything will be okay. We'll test the audio and everything. But staying with you a bit more, Charlotte, you had talked about, actually, that you've seen, on the one hand, we talked about the United States and what is doing. On the other hand, you talked about the resistance and how you haven't seen so much as far as people becoming more aware of the Palestinian situation. I want to talk about your personal experience, because you are an activist in Canada, and what you have seen since October 7th there.
Cool. What we've seen is a really sustained mobilization and just a really large scale anger and commitment to continue to act, and a real outrage at the Canadian government, at Canadian officials and institutions that continue to behave in mechanism that is completely complicit with the genocide, while the vast majority of people here are demanding that they stop doing it. I mean, there, time after time, poll after poll showed that the majority of Canadians, at the very least, want a ceasefire and the U.S. and Israel to stop bombing and attacking Gaza. So what does the Canadian government do? Instead, it goes and participates in the U.S.-UK assault on Yemen. Goes about defunding UNRWA. These are not things that are supported by people on the ground. And that's why every single weekend, and for that matter, every single day, there are demonstrations of thousands of people in all of the major cities and hundreds of people in many towns throughout Canada. People fundamentally are appalled by the very reality that they see of what Zionism is.
Okay, there's, and that's quite amazing, especially in the cold of Canada right now. That's actually quite impressive. Well, Peter, I'm glad you joined us. Peter, in November, Congress allocated $14.5 billion more for the Israeli genocide, and now set to vote to give even more money to the Israeli regime. I mean, why is this the case when the U.S. itself has a growing poverty problem and a crumbling infrastructure, and their own people are definitely under pressure? So your thoughts on that side of things?
It's a very good question, and many Americans themselves are asking that question. Why is America funding Israel to the tune of billions and billions of dollars to carry out the genocide, while folks back home in America hardly have enough to live on, and the infrastructure is crumbling? And the answer, of course, is politics and money, especially in an election year. The bottom line is that Biden and all the leading candidates are dependent on the pro-Israel lobby. If the pro-Israel lobby turns against them, they are finished. And so it goes on time after time. This is not about American interests. It's about Israeli interests. The ordinary people don't get a say, especially when the mass media, the mainstream media, are so one-sided. Just today, new evidence has emerged of how biased CNN is from the very top. Ordinary CNN journalists are protesting because they're not allowed to report impartially, but they get orders from the very top of CNN to present only the Israeli point of view. So it's no wonder that American support for Israel is so one-sided.
Well, let me just jump in here, Peter. You said something interesting that because it's an election year, well, one would think because it's an election year, then actually, if the people really had power to elect who they wanted, that the genocide would be stopped immediately since the majority of people are not pro-genocide, and that because it's an election year, they would the politicians would try to appease the people more. But what you have said about the Israeli lobby, do you think that just really says who controls not only the elections, but Washington politics in general?
Well, when all the candidates are pro-Israel, the people have no choice. You know, the choice is being pro-Israeli, very pro-Israeli, or most pro-Israeli. You can't be pro-Palestinian in the U.S. presidential and congressional elections. It's very simple. The ordinary people have no choice, but the polls show that many younger people in particular, and in particular people who would lean towards the Democrats, are disgusted by Biden's effective support for genocide. And it may well be the case that they will simply abstain. They will vote with their feet by staying at home. And this is something that even Biden has to pay attention to. And this is why America pretends to be concerned about Palestinian lives, pretends to be supporting a Palestinian state. That is just to appease those young Democrats who are not going to vote for Biden. But it's all theater.
Well, Charlotte, if the mentality in the West is to support genocide, is there a middle ground that people in West Asia and the Global South can have with this perspective? Or basically, are we on a continuous crash course with the rulers of Western hegemony and the Global South?
Well, we're on a crash course with imperialism and Zionism. And it's really clear that, you know, but one of the things that's actually hopeful is that we're seeing these very large numbers of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people in the heart of the imperial core saying, no, we stand with the Global South, not only saying, you know, we want a ceasefire now, but we support the Palestinian resistance. And this is something that's increasingly clear. And what that means is that it's not possible for these states to, for too long, sustain this ongoing war machine targeting the Palestinian people and targeting everyone in the region. But the fact is that these imperialist forces have shown time and time again that rather than, you know, attempting to sort of preserve some form of minimal peace in the region, you know, where they engage in pressure campaigns, but they sort of pull back the attack dogs of the Zionist regime from like this extreme genocide, they're not doing that. They've had months and months and months to do that. And rather than do that, they're passing a bill to send $14 billion more weapons to continue the genocide more effectively with more bombs and bullets and destructive force. So there's no mechanism by which these forces become supporters of, you know, peace and justice and a future for people in the region. Instead, they have to be defeated, and they're on the road to being defeated.
Well, Peter, it is not only Gaza, but also the occupied West Bank, which is experiencing extreme violence from the Zionist regime. Young and old, male and female, are arrested, tortured, and killed by the regime. Now, with this type of entity and this type of violence against the people, what option does the Palestinians have except resistance against this apartheid regime? How do you see it?
Personally, I feel they are being given no option other than armed resistance. I myself, when I was a diplomat in the British Foreign Office, worked on the Middle East peace process in the early days and high hopes. were alive then and for a number of years afterwards, but for at least the last 10 years, it has been obvious that peace talks, the Middle East peace process, is just theater, just a charade, not serious. In fact, it's been just a cover for the Israelis to increase their land grabs and to absorb more and more of the West Bank. You cannot blame the Palestinians for concluding in these circumstances that talks about two-state solution is just a cover for the Israelis to grab more land, for the settlers to come in ever greater numbers. And talk of going to international courts, it's good in a way, but it's not going to deliver Palestinian rights. So you can't blame Palestinians if they feel they have no recourse but to take up arms or to support resistance groups like Hamas.
You said, Peter, staying with you, you said that it's been the last 10 years specifically that you haven't believed that the goal is actually peace. What about from the very beginning of the peace talks? Do you think from the very beginning it was a plot by the regime just to delay the inevitable, which was for them to steal more Israeli property?
Well, historians will argue about this. Certainly, I had the impression, being heavily personally involved right at the beginning, that it was serious, that on the side of the Israelis at that time, and in particular Rabin, that there was a serious intention to move forward towards allowing a Palestinian state to come into existence. But we know what happened to Rabin. He was assassinated by Israeli fanatics who then more or less altered the peace process and made it eventually into just a cover story while they got on with occupying and quietly annexing the West Bank.
Okay.
But in the first few years, there was, I think, genuine hope. But those days are long gone. There is nobody like that today. There is no partner for peace in Israel today.
Okay. Well, Charlotte, do you think the Israeli regime can recover from this genocide it has committed and its total military failure in Gaza, where none of its goals have been met?
In the long run, no, absolutely not. I mean, this genocide that's being carried out as part of the death knell of the Zionist project in occupied Palestine. And we're seeing this also in the way that while Palestinians have come together, united, forged a very strong sense of national unity, uniting around the resistance, standing together against the genocide, what we see on the Zionist side are every politician for themselves, every political figure scrambling for influence and power. We see the blatant fascists, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, proudly declaring how they're planning to steal more Palestinian land in the next days. We see Netanyahu determined to kill as many Palestinians as possible so that he remains in power and out of jail. We're seeing this, and the absolute exposure of the reality of what Zionism is and what colonialism in Palestine means to everyone around the world. For so long, the Zionist regime has maintained this illusion of the impenetrability and the strength of its army and its military, that it can't be defeated. But what we're seeing right now is that the Palestinian resistance, under siege for over 17 years with weapons that they've manufactured themselves, defeating this so-called undefeatable army. Instead, right, all that the Zionists are able to do is drop bombs and kill civilians. And that's a reality of a dying project, a settler colonial project that is failing and coming to its end.
Well, Peter, do you think with the U.S.-supported genocide that not only has Washington lost credibility worldwide, but it is being scrutinized more by its own citizens as they question the country's militarism and could ultimately cause more pressure inside of the United States itself?
I'm not optimistic, I have to say, because of the deep forces which control U.S. politics. I mean, Congress is the best parliament that you can buy. Senators, congressmen, it is well known, are easily bought, and this situation is not going to change. Whatever the people want is secondary to the forces that support militarism, and of course the arms manufacturers play a huge role here, and this complex was identified by President Eisenhower 70, 80 years ago when he spoke about the military-industrial complex which Americans had to beware of. Well, it's still there today, only it's expanded to include the media, big high-tech, and academe, universities. Mm.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Well, Charlotte, there are no sanctions on Israel and no no-fly zones that have been implemented to stop its genocide. What the regime has is the total support of the Western Front of hegemony. When this is the reality, what would you say is the responsibility of the anti-genocide front?
The responsibility of the anti-genocide front in all of its forms, in all of its places, whether that is the resistance that's fighting on the ground, whether that are states that are working to hold the Zionist regime accountable in international courts, and whether that's our popular movement on the streets around the world, is to do everything possible to bring this genocide to an end and to support the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea. And that means confronting not only the Zionist regime for its direct genocide on Gaza, but the United States, Britain, Germany, France, Canada, and all of the partners in the attacks on Yemen, on the attacks on Iraq and Syria, on the attempts to fundamentally destroy the region's ability to stand together and stand for itself and be free of colonialism, hegemony, and external domination. And this is a responsibility of all of us. That means building our boycott campaigns. That means getting in the streets. That means confronting arms manufacturers like Palestine Action is doing. Every single person can play a role in a united front against genocide that spans across the globe and stands together with the Palestinian people and their resistance on the front lines of struggle.
Well, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, out of Manchester. Charlotte Cates, international coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, out of Vancouver. And thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanking you for myself and other crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو إذا الرحمن
Allah
هو إذا المنان
لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atar, the host of this program. We have a special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Zain. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, Sayyid Zain, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of, we can say, hijab, dress code, and the covering. We know that according to the religion of Islam, hijab, which is a dress code, and is not only limited to the women because it puts effa and chastity for both men and women, is a way in order to have a more, we can say, afif life, a kind of chasteful life. If you observe chastity in your life on that time, that would prepare the way, or it's better to say, pave the way for you to go to the Jannah. And this is what is promised by Allah Subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is about this world. Of course, there are so many discussions regarding the concept of hijab for the women. How do we call the precise and the exact hijab or dress code? And in different cultures of the Islamic lands, nowadays you could find different types of dress code and hijab. First, talk a little bit about the concept of hijab for us, and then we'll get to the hijab in the other world. Does it have any meaning in the other world or not?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. So hijab, it's a command, obviously, of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that both men and women, they have to observe, as you said, at different levels. The amount of covering differs for them based on their what they're like, what their nature is like, based on society, how it perceives them. So that is the law of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, the reason for hijab, from what I understand, is not just so that other people don't look at you in the wrongful way, right? Hijab and covering and clothing, that's not the only purpose of it. Yes, that is one of the main purpose, but it's also respect and dignity,
yes,
right? That a person who wears, the proper kind of clothing,
yes,
they have that dignity as well, the sign of dignity. Uh-huh. So if you were to look at, cultures throughout history, throughout the world, yes, as well, it's not specific to some, yes, region of the world.
Yes.
That clothing was a sign of nobility. It was a sign of respect.
Yes.
People of more nobility in societies, yes, they would generally wear more clothes.
This is according to what we could see, for example, in the paintings, in the right, sculptures, and different things. The people who were covered in clothing, they had more respect, right, even in the upper classes of the society. Mm-hmm. Right. That's right. Okay.
So that was the case, and that is the case, that, yes, people who have proper clothing, even, yes, if you see, look at the scholars,
yes,
even,
yes,
nowadays they would wear more clothing. If you look at graduation ceremonies,
yes,
right, they would wear something very resembling Islamic scholars. They would, yes, wear the capes and,
yes,
the hats,
yes,
and it shows respect, dignity, knowledge. So clothing is not just for, you know, that other people don't see. Now, what happened with the modern world was a removal and overthrowing of all traditions, in a sense, slow overthrowing of it, such that, you know, clothing was also, you know, taken out and removed to a large extent.
Even the Western world has differed from its 50 years ago.
Right, very much so. Yeah. Very much so.
I mean, 50 years ago, you got the footage, you know, and the people, for example, in the Europe, in the United States of America, you could find more chaste TV serials, you know, covering the bodies, even the women, you know,
for
cover from neck to toe. Mm-hmm. But nowadays,